Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to the May edition of City Talks. My guest this month is Mike Emmerich, and we'll be talking about his new book, Britain's Cities, Britain's Future. Before that, I'm joined by my colleagues Paul Swinney and Simon Jeffrey to discuss the Metro Mayor elections. So, a week on from those elections, we now have our winners. Interestingly, four Conservative and only two Labour. Simon, that was a bit of a surprise, wasn't it?
It was a bit of a surprise. I'd like to take a bit of credit for certain cities that we had sort of done our analysis and said there was not as big a gap as you'd expect in Tees Valley between the Conservatives and Labour. Actually, not that much bigger than in the West Midlands, which people did recognise as a close race. And obviously in the Tees Valley, that big Brexit vote, the big UKIP vote that we saw in 2015 did what it looks like it's done everywhere and went across to just push Ben Houchin over the line. The thing is, that was the lowest turnout. I think he won in Darlington and Stockton, where he's the leader of the Tory group on the council there. And so he lost the other three authorities, but that just got him over the line where, you know, Hartlepool, I think, was under 18% turnout. So, you know, really strong victory for the Conservatives there, but on a low turnout.
Yeah, we'll come back to turnout in a minute. We had what we knew was going to happen in Greater Manchester and Liverpool City Region. Both returned resounding victories for their Labour mayors, Paul.
Yeah, big victories there, which, as we say, wasn't much of a surprise. I think probably what is a little bit more of a surprise, sort of looking at all of the results as a whole, is that, you know, when George Osborne introduced this topic, you know, 2 years ago, policy 2 years ago, I think there were a few people, certainly within his party, said, well, why are you creating these new powerful positions that are going to go to Labour candidates, going to go to Labour politicians further north? And actually, that hasn't happened. We've seen four of the six mayoralties that have been created actually go blue, which is sort of the general surprise. Obviously, Manchester and Liverpool have now got very powerful Labour politicians. What will then be interesting for them is about how they work with the national government of the day, particularly assuming, as Paul seems to suggest, that will remain blue after the 8th of June.
Yeah, and Simon, west of England won by the Tories, but in... We didn't see a sort of Liberal Democrat revival that we thought might happen.
I think we almost did. I mean, it's an interesting race that there were five candidates that got over 10%, I think. You know, going up from the Greens, there was a big independent guy called John Savage who sort of got over 20,000 votes, nearly 30,000 votes, actually. So there was an issue where I think the Liberal Democrats, the candidate Steve Williams, the ex-MP and minister, only just came behind the Labour candidate, Leslie Mansell, by a couple of thousand. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, if he'd have just gotten through to the second round, because there were so many second preferences to play for, I think the Conservative candidate only got 27% in the first round, Labour got 22. You know, that was, more than half of the votes could have conceivably gone to one of the other candidates. But because it's so split, and the way that the voting system works, actually, if you don't know who the final two are going to be, which in that case is probably a lot of, you know, people expected the Lib Dem to get through to the final round. So they might have voted Labour first or they might have voted for someone else first. And those votes have just never come into play after that. So while we didn't see the Lib Dem revival that you might have expected as the only party that's had MPs in all of the constituencies around there, I understand, it was only just, you know, I think if they'd gotten through to the second round, there's so many of those second preferences to play for that, you know, they'll be ruining the voting system, I imagine, there.
Yeah, and, you know, lots of concerns in the run-up, you know, lots of activity in all of those places around the need to drum up awareness, get people out to vote, concerns that turnout would be unbelievably and damagingly low. That wasn't the case. So you said, you know, Tees Valley was, what, around the 20% mark?
Yeah.
But then in some places, we were over the 30% mark as well. So that's encouraging from a mandate, credibility, legitimacy point, that they're not starting from a particularly weakened place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think on the face of it, you know, the figures that we're talking about in terms of turnout aren't massive, but they're definitely higher than where I think we thought they were going to be. And that's encouraging that more people came out to vote than what we expected. And I think if you look at sort of the history of, say, the London mayor, actually you saw the first vote there was pretty low in terms of turnout, and it has built since then. I think what we'd hope now is that, you know, as people start to get their heads around what this mayoral role is, you know, the person's actually going to be positioned, going to be doing things for the next 3 years, hopefully doing very good things for the people who live and work in those areas, actually awareness increases and that pulls up more people in the future. So I think actually we started from quite a good base that we hope we can then go on from.
Okay, so let's move on to... they've been in post now for a week. Have we had any... some of the policy announcements that we've seen beginning to emerge from different candidates? Simon, you know, what noises are we hearing from the mayors already?
Well, potentially as a sign of things to come, the Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, and the Conservative Mayor of the West Midlands, Andy Street, have both come out in the first week of their first... order of business has been to tackle rough sleeping, which is obviously one of the most visible things in a city, and actually, you know, there are big issues around that people who have to use the city centre every day, it's obviously a poor situation for people on the street, and it really does damage the image of a place. But that's what they've both gone in for, and you know, Ed Glaser said there's no left or right wing way to take out the rubbish, then potentially this is what mayors do in a lot of cities where there are competitive races. They actually try and address the problems not on a ideological basis, but on a problem-solving basis.
And it's an interesting one that, you know, this is an issue which may or may not sit squarely with in the mayor's formal powers and remit, but nevertheless, it's a very emotive issue, it's a very visible issue, and mayors tend to go for those sorts of issues, which is a good reminder about how this might evolve. Paul?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the powers that have been passed down in the devolution deals are great, you know, first step on it, hopefully what is a longer journey in terms of passing more powers down. But I think that, you know, the real value of a mayor is not just using those powers, but actually trying to use his or her influence as well. And the mayors that have been elected, they need to be sort of setting out their plan about what they want to do for their area. And then that allows different public bodies to fall underneath that, and actually private sector bodies as well, come to mention it. Go, actually, the mayor's trying to achieve this. Right, okay, I understand that, and this is how we might well fit into it. And it's about using that influence and perhaps sort of, you know, slowly extending that reach into areas that that haven't got formal powers over to really sort of help bring value, I think, not only to their position, but actually in terms of the impact they have on people's day-to-day lives.
I think it's a response to something that came up really strongly in the campaigns, and the local press have covered it as well. And it's a symbol of what a mayor can do. Like you say, this lightning rod for people to, you know, point their issues with their city at, and someone who's actually there at the top who can, like Paul says, butt heads together and set a direction, and people can feel that there is a clear response to their pressing demands in a city.
So it'll be interesting to see over the next, I guess, week, maybe 2 weeks, how some of the other mayors now begin to set out a more organised programme of activity that's organised around a vision and a purpose, how they really want to, you know, to be the mayor of their particular place. It'll be interesting to see what happens over the next couple of weeks, I think. One of the issues, obviously, and one of the important roles for the mayor is to be a conduit to and to engage with government. You know, give us your thoughts on, you know, 4 out of the 6 are Conservative. We're likely to have a Conservative government returned on July the 9th. Does that matter? In what way might that make a difference, Simon?
Well, that is what the Conservatives have been playing on in the campaign, as a bridge to government. And I think if you do look at what has been going on in Greater Manchester and Liverpool, the candidates there have been acting the role of a defender against the government. And we've spoken to Ed Lister and Neil Coleman, and they did both say that actually, you know, working with government, whether you're from a different party, is the best way to get results. So whether the rhetoric of the campaign is going to, you know, turn into the pros of, you know, getting along with government now they're in post, that is going to have to be a change in attitude, probably, from, or change in language.
And it'll be an important one, won't it? I think, you know, to put themselves consistently at loggerheads in conflict with government, whilst make good politics, It won't make for a, you know, for a good, effective mayor that is able to get things done.
And it won't help the people that they're there to serve. And that's going to be a big challenge. And I think this flips the other way as well, in that where we've got Conservative mayors in areas that have been traditionally Labour, Labour voting, or have got Labour councils, then they will have to build relationships there too. And I think this is a crucial point about the mayors and how successful those individual people will be. But how good are they at being politicians? How good are they at building relationships both locally and nationally to try and sort of deliver value and really sort of put, create more jobs and put more money in the pockets of the people they're there to represent?
Yes, but a good point. So let's think about what next. What next for those areas and those mayors? You know, in a sense, what would we be looking for? What should we keep our eye on? And then I think there's a question more broadly about what next for Metro Mayors as a policy idea. But in terms of the Metro Mayors that we've got, what should we be looking for? What should we be keeping an eye on over the next 6-12 months, Paul?
I think for the mayors themselves, as you already said, Andrew, it's about trying, you know, what are they going to do over the next 100 days? How are they going to set out what their position is going to be? I think they've got a little bit of cover probably because of the election coming up. I think a lot of attention is probably going to be diverted to what's going to happen on June the 8th. But after that, I think a lot of eyes will be on about what are you going to do. I think that's actually particularly crucial for, say, particularly in Tees Valley and in the west of England, where actually both victors didn't actually have a manifesto. And I think they need to be now thinking about, well, what are we going to do? What is our plan for this area? I think in terms of sort of national government, or national politics, there's a question about, well, what's going to be set out in the manifestos? What is the next government going to do around devolution? Are they going to look to extend it or not? Have the Tories now been galvanised by what's happened in terms of them winning 4 of the 6 seats? Will that sort of refocus attention where it seemed to have waned a little bit? But I think, you know, one of the big issues around this topic, you know, we're talking about these 6 places. I think it's not just the fact that we've got 6 places. Actually, there's an elephant in the room that there are at least 3 other cities that haven't got a metro mayor that probably should do. And I think it's the question then about, well, what is national government going to do about that? But actually, what are these places going to do too? What is the wider Newcastle area going to do about this? What's West Yorkshire going to do about this in particular? You know, are they going to go back and having seen this, actually try and get a devolution deal in place? Because the places that have got a deal in place have got a mayor in place and now sort of cracking on and using the powers that are being passed down.
Yeah, lots of pressure on the mayors, Simon, in a sense. On the one hand, you know, the mayor, Andy Street, a lot of pressure on him to prove that, you know, conservatism is relevant for big urban areas.
Yeah.
Lots of pressure on the Labour mayors, Rotherham and Andy Burnham, around showing that, you know, Labour is sensible and appropriate and can govern in the interest of the wider good.
Well, without wanting to prejudge the election result, it does look like, you know, if the polls are to be believed, it's going to be Steve Rotherham, Andy Burnham and Sadiq Khan will be the 3 biggest Labour figures in England come June the 9th. And they will have a big job on their shoulders if it is as bad as they say at, you know, keeping that brand going. If you look at the result, Andy Burnham did fantastically well, actually, in Greater Manchester, which shows what having the personalities there. But as being mayors, you know, first 100 days, we've always said there needs to be a quick win. And the quick win, so in Liverpool, we thought, so, you know, getting the travel right, improving the bus system, those are the real things. And trying to bring on the bus services, building the improvements in that, those are going to be the quick wins that are, A, going to get people enthused about the mayor and see what value it is, and B, next time round, going to add to that sense of legitimacy and mandate, and hopefully, you know, get the other parties and the manifestos and people thinking much more about what they can do. Mm. And probably another factor is getting those other places that Paul mentioned, not just about government thinking about what are we not doing for this, or getting people in those places saying, well, why haven't we got this?
Yeah. And what about the mayors working together? You know, we've talked about, you know, the mayors organising themselves in their place. Definitely a job of work to be done about how the mayors come together, the 6 that are currently, but also, you know, Sadiq Khan as the mayor of London, thinking about how they organise themselves to both talk to government and indeed to talk to other parts of the world in terms of attracting investment, attracting jobs, attracting talent.
Definitely. I think there's an element of learning from each other as well. You know that these are new positions, and we've got some seasoned politicians taking these positions, that others that aren't. I think there's a lot to probably be learned about how you go about being a mayor of these places. I think it's interesting that Sadiq Khan has already had telephone conversations with all of the new mayors, and clearly he wants to be looking to have conversations with them, understand what they're doing. London does have a history of talking to the core cities. and try to talk the urban agenda. And I think what we want to see is those mayors pushing the urban agenda, you know, for within the UK to say, no, our cities are dead important. This is where you have majority of people. This is where you have majority of jobs. This is where their policy should be focused as a result of that. I think having said that, you know, it'd be great to have them working together, and I'm sure they're going to be. But of course, they then represent their areas too.
Yeah.
And it does mean that actually there will be some areas of direct competition implicitly between different places, particularly in terms of attracting an investment. I think the mayors probably have to, you know, be able to balance that, appreciating that they are in competition to some extent, but actually there's a lot to begin through collaboration in other areas too.
Final thought from you, Simon, on this balance about working together, but also, you know, recognising that they have to defend and argue the case for their place.
Well, that's the great thing, I think, where the city leadership, you know, through the core cities and the Mayor of London, it's not zero sum. What is good for London is good for the country and for other cities. And the more that they work together and understand that, then what's good for cities is good for the country. And that's, you know, central to what we think, and I think that is what should be the big result coming out of these new mayors.
Exciting times indeed. My thanks to Paul and Simon. Why did Britain's cities, once the engines of the Industrial Revolution and the envy of the world, decline so dramatically? What is fueling their tentative revival, and what needs to be done if our major cities are once again to be the engines of Britain's economy? Mike Emmerich's new book, Britain's Cities, Britain's Future, answers these questions, drawing out the lessons of the last 200 years. In the book, Mike argues that only by really understanding these lessons do we have any hope of creating a prosperous post-Brexit Britain. Mike is uniquely well placed to write this book. He's worked at the heart of British government in the Treasury at Number 10, and for the last decade or so, he has played a central role in the devolution revolution in Greater Manchester. Mike, welcome to City Talks.
Hello.
So let's start off with, give us a motivation as to why you wanted to write the book, why you felt it was important now, and then we'll get into some of the detail of what the book was looking at.
Oh, I wrote the book because Diane Coyle asked me to do it. I've been blogging a bit since we started Metrodynamics. As ideas have come to me, I've sort of put pen to paper, so to speak, and written stuff. And I thought there was a voice waiting to get out with some bigger ideas. She took me for breakfast, and we agreed that I should write a book in her series. And I guess the question is, you know, not why cities and why economics and politics, because that's been my life for 30 years.
Yeah.
I guess the question really you're asking is, why do a sort of historical piece? Because what I tried to do really was to ground everything I've been doing in my career, which is, you know, three quarters of the way through. It feels like a good time to take stock. I hope it's three quarters of the way through. and ask some questions. And what really struck me, because I've been involved in heritage, I was on the Heritage Lottery Fund board and things like that, was, you know, knowing enough economic history to know that Britain more or less invented the modern city, and knowing that at one point, you know, Cottonopolis and the cotton textiles industry was the overwhelming majority of Britain's exports.
Yeah.
How on earth had we contrived to become a place like Britain today, where even after the most sustained period of leadership, with billions of pounds spent during the longest boom since records began, we've still got cities that on most figures are economically weak and are politically weak too. And I'd seen ministers and leaders of every party try and wrestle with this, and yet these seemed intractable problems. And so it just seemed to me, as I thought about this, that there was something deeper going on here that I hadn't seen written up in a way that was satisfactory for my kind of audience, a policy, an economically literate policy sort of audience. So I decided to take a sort of an historical perspective, so that what will, you know, what I hope will come out of it, though of course I wasn't sure, was something that might give us some clues about the way Britain developed and why it is that... that despite being first, despite being in some senses best in class at the time, we seem to have really laboured with this process of economic development, urban regeneration, spatial imbalances, and that's why I took the historical perspective.
So let's get into that. So just start off with, what's the time period that we're looking at? We talk about the Industrial Revolution, but just, you know, where are we starting from? And paint a picture of of Britain, I suppose, at that point, and then we can look forward as the Industrial Revolution really got underway.
There's a very quick look at what happened before the Industrial Revolution, and there's been a big debate on Twitter this week. Could the Industrial Revolution have happened somewhere
else?
Indeed,
where could it have been?
I mean, fascinating. But I start before the Industrial Revolution because what's clear is it wasn't some magic thing that happened everywhere at the same time. It wasn't about climatic conditions. It wasn't even just about factors of production. It wasn't about luck, though all of those things played a role. A lot of it was due to the fact that in the pre-industrial period, Britain had been internationalising. It had a good period of growth. There'd been land reform, so there's a lot of surplus labour as the Enclosure Act sort of freed up huge amounts of labour here, and the potato famine in Ireland meant that there was a potential to use labour that had never previously been available. And of course, the heart of it is innovation, is that tightly knit communities, small communities in Lancashire especially, southeast Lancashire especially, northeast Cheshire, places like that, that they were where some of the people who had these innovative ideas decided to set up shop and to try and use these machines, these ideas, to start to manufacture on a larger scale.
Yeah.
And it's a whole series of things. There's, you can look for a monocausal explanation and there isn't one.
No.
But the fact that Arkwright and Co. decided, Arkwright started in Derbyshire,
yep.
but actually moved to Lancashire because he realised that was a better place to do it because they had all the advantages of Derbyshire in terms of raw materials, in terms of access to water, whatever. But there was something about the foment of what was already going in Lancashire, other people who were working on ideas, there were ready populations, and there were people to work in the new factories.
Yeah.
And it's that proto-industrial period that I think seems to mark out the Lancashire cotton industry in particular as being different. And that's, I hope I've done him justice, but Nick Craft's work on this at Warwick,
brilliant.
Absolutely fundamentally, the thing I've read probably more than anything else, because to talk about a generalised industrial revolution, something that happened at the same time across the whole country in every industry, just doesn't seem to square with the data. What seems to have happened, for sure, there was development, industrial development, in lots of places and lots of sectors, but it was the cotton industry and to a degree the iron industry that seems in certain places to have taken an agricultural revolution and to take the people, the capital, the ideas and turn it into an industrial revolution.
Yeah.
And that was the kernel of the argument that I started with.
And in part of I was interested in that. Immediately from the outset, you're talking about economic change, you're talking about political change, technological change, but you're also then looking at how the coevolution of community and societal and religious institutions, is embedded into and is connected to and is driving some of that economic change as well. In a sense, a lot of analysis treats these things as two separate, doesn't it? Rather than looking at it in the round. And, I think you say a bit more about that, but I thought that was a really fascinating insight about how those things were happening alongside each other in parallel and feeding off each other as well.
If you've done what I've done for a living, for a lot of my life, working in a place or now in different places, there's only so much you can ever get from the economic statistics.
Yeah.
Why is it that, I was in Liverpool yesterday, why is it Liverpool feels so different to Manchester, feels so different to Newcastle or Cardiff?
Yeah.
After 200 years of global competition, the forces affecting every area are literally global. A lot of the shops are the same. People drink the same beer. They go watch the same films. And yet, today, you go to these places and they feel distinctively different. There's something about the places themselves that goes beyond the economic. And I've been accused of being an economic fascist by a former colleague of mine at the University of Manchester, an epistemological fascist to be precise, but it was economics she was referring to. But I would be among the first, probably not the first, but certainly not the last either, to say these data are telling us really important things. Of course, the data, when you go back in time, aren't great, which is why Nick Craft's work is so fundamentally important for everything we do. But you know... as you look at places, that the buildings, the culture has been influenced by a journey, and that can't be explained solely in terms of the businesses. And I, of course, like everybody else who was working in government during the last part of the old millennium and into the noughties, you know, the whole social capital debate was a big debate for us, particularly the work of Bob Putnam, the notion of bonding social capital and bridging social capital and how that affected places. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to just look at places through that lens and see what they could teach us? And for sure, what comes out of that is exactly what Peter Hall wrote about in a very different language, but meaning exactly the same thing, which is, of course, what Alfred Marshall was writing about using a different language again. Yeah. And then everybody's fed off all of those guys later on. Is that it wasn't about markets, though markets were fundamental. It was about relationships. It was about kith and kin.
Yeah.
It was about community. And, you know, what the picture you get reading the stories of you know, quite modest small towns as well as big cities is of places that were very, very different to the prevailing culture of Anglo-Saxon England as it had obtained for hundreds of years since the Reformation, of non-conformist cities, of Catholic cities, you know, with sizable Jewish populations as well, where there was a melting pot. They were very American. I mean, the more you look at Cotonopolis and some of the other cities, because Cotonopolis is a term that was used for Manchester, but you have Worcesteropolis in Bradford or a whole host of other places, the more they start to look like a counterculture, almost like a San Francisco-type counterculture of their time, but with religion playing a role, and that religion being absolutely nothing like restricted to the chapel, or indeed the synagogue, though they played a big role. But it underpinned the education system, it underpinned the politics of these places, and seems to have been one of the arteries of bonding social capital that through which these places came to be what they were.
And those issues, I mean, as you said, those issues, those elements were not by any means incidental. You know, they were fundamental to, you know, the evolution and the revolution in some respects that was going on in our urban areas, whether it's Manchester and the, you know, the smaller towns around it, or Leeds and Bradford, and what was going on there, or Birmingham. You know, the factors you're talking about were fundamental to, you know, to how those cities evolved and grew incredibly rapidly over a very, very short period of time.
Absolutely. If your kids can't go to university, if they are, in some important respects, second-class citizens in the country because they're not Anglicans in this, you know, late 18th, early 19th century period, that forces people into each other's arms. I mean, yeah. I quote the example of Owens College in Manchester, which became one of the founding bits of the University of Manchester, where he literally had no kids himself, but he bequeathed a load of money to set up an institution where neither the teachers nor the students had to pass any sort of religious test. And it, you know, that was because he'd grown up in an area, he was a nonconformist, and he'd seen that there was a need for this. And in a funny sort of way, it had been religious persecution until relatively recently, and so it was certainly. Yeah. It was certainly religious minorities finding, as they do in modern cities today, in different religions by and large, not exclusive, but by and large, you know, they create subcultures and people come together because of their difference.
Yeah.
The other difference, and you alluded to it then in terms of growth, is the size of this phenomenon. I mean, anyone who worries about population change in British cities ought to get their head around the fact that Manchester's population went up from like 90 to 300,000 in a period of 40 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a major expansion of population. It was too fast, it was too much, and there were horrendous social consequences as a result. But those people who were coming, most of them, certainly a very large proportion of them, weren't established members of the High Anglican Church. They were nonconformists and they were Catholics, because a lot of them came over from Ireland.
Yeah. And one of the interesting elements Manchester is regarded as what, the first industrial city. And I think in the book you're quite clear about that many of the changes, many of the revolution, many of the technological innovation, many of the institutions were non-political you know, in a sense, they were very much driven by either the landed aristocracy, which were actually making capital available
in
quite an open
canals,
and interesting way, but also by entrepreneurs and business people themselves, that they were very much at the forefront of city building, rather than, you know, in a more classic modern sense, we class city building as being something that primarily is done by the public sector. But is that right? In a sense, it was very much an entrepreneurial or non-political driven process when we see Manchester evolve and develop?
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, perhaps we'll come on in a bit to the sort of critiques of what I've written. But, you know, a lot of those critiques come from an analysis that says that, you know, politics should do more. There should be more interventionist regional policy with more investment and more direction in a French or a German or a Scandinavian sense. And again, that's part of the reason for deciding to, you know, I'm not an historian. I don't have a history qualification. But the reason for doing it was because I had a whole sense that there was a story here, and there is a story. It is that you know, the world described in Hard Times by Charles Dickens of entrepreneurs, of utilitarianism, though I think it is a substantially inaccurate picture, has elements of truth about it.
Yeah.
You know, the business people, I think they were largely businessmen of the late 18th and early to mid 19th century, believe profoundly and passionately in the power of markets and in the power of their businesses and in the supremacy of business. And, you know, looking ironically to Florence as their model, which of course had a very strong government which funded a great deal of Renaissance art. And as a consequence of that, you know, places like Manchester had, I think, no parliamentary representation, had no municipal authorities, because these are essentially new places. I think there is an element of hubris about this, and what happened was, you know, to take one example, the Anti-Corn Law League, which is probably the movement with which Cottonopolis and those cotton towns were most associated, had done nearly all of its work, had achieved its goal before Manchester had a city.
Yeah.
And that can't be unlinked to the fact that there was a public health crisis.
No.
You know, growing 300,000 population in you know, 30, 40 years, building houses on a very large scale, very often almost exclusively in working class areas without sanitation, you know, created a public health crisis which good government would have helped resolve, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's no doubt about it that's part of the story. Now, the interesting thing is not that was a fact at the time, that it's what did that mean for what happened next?
Well, I think that's right. And I think what's interesting in the book, and you see this in other examples as well, you know, think about some other cities that you refer to, I mean, actually talk a little bit about comparing, you know, the dominance and influence of cotton in industrial Manchester with the dominance and influence of financial services in, you know, current London. And I think, you know, the sense that if we're not careful, the very reasons why places do well ultimately also sow the seeds of their decline if they're not managed carefully or not thought about carefully. And I think, you know, there's a lot in the book around, just as Manchester was reaching its, you know, its zenith in terms of its market share in certain industries at the global scale, never mind at the national scale, already, you know, there were weaknesses in the system that as the prevailing conditions changed, became much more obvious and evident.
Yeah, I mean, probably most, you know, this is a very short book. It's a policy perspective.
Yeah.
It's a provocation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there's relatively limited time and scope to undertake extensive research. But I got drawn deeper and deeper into looking at research on 19th century cities, and in particular on the nature of urbanisation around the world. And what is absolutely clear, there's some lovely quotes I know from Education Commission, was that it was painfully obvious by the mid to late 19th century that this phenomenon of very business-led small state capitalism in 19th century England in particular had a weakness, which is that the people who'd learnt from that, who didn't have the costs of first mover disadvantage, who were the second movers, Prussia, later Germany and Japan and America, they found a different and better way. The Prussians in particular decided, as a matter of state policy, to invest in skills. And they worked out that if they were ever going to catch us, that's what they had to do.
Yeah.
And we could never respond to that. And in part, it's because I don't think we wanted to.
Right.
I think we and if you think about how, I go back to that critique of what, people, there's a lot of people in academia especially would say, well, we need better, stronger, deeper government. Something with which, in some senses, I would personally agree. But our prevailing culture has never seen politics in that central sense. I mean, I remember in Treasury, a lot of people used to argue routinely that France isn't a capitalist nation in any sense. It's actually, the anarchs run the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. You don't have to agree with that to see that politics goes deeper into the fabric and government goes deeper into the fabric of the country than it ever has on a successful basis here.
Yeah.
And my argument is that that's not an accident. That's not a little thing. It's the path dependency of how we grew as a country means that we just don't want government. We just don't seem to want government doing things that other countries seem to want governments to do. And I think that is to our cost.
Yeah.
And I crystallise it, not by talking about government, because actually it's not just government. It's institutions of every kind. It could be the church, though again, I don't have a particular flag to fly for the church. Mm. It could be government, or it could be business institutions. It could be innovation institutions, but the mentality of the 19th century cotton entrepreneur, who is perhaps the kind of the caricature par excellence of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, is somebody for whom government was a bad thing. And I think that is now kind of hardwired into how we think as a country. Aided and abetted, I have to say, by Margaret Thatcher in what she did.
Now,
Whatever the rights and wrongs of what had to be done in Britain and whether or not, something was needed after Barbara Castle was beaten on in place of strife, which I think is probably true. The version of capitalism that she tried to sell us, of cold, hard, clinical markets and small entrepreneurs, whilst it is indeed a part of every economy, is actually quite a small part of successful economies where the socialisation of business through institutions of innovation, we could talk about some great examples of that. Through innovation, skills, and other things, or just statutory chambers in continental Europe. These are a fundamental part of why it is that other economies have got stronger governance of a private sector kind, a public sector kind, previously a religious kind as well. And that my point is that that might be part of the story of their success.
The distinctions you draw between almost the differing approaches of Germany, Prussia, and Britain in that period in the way that we thought about skills, I just thought was such a fantastic insight into a much bigger issue. Learning on the job, very much providing the skill that was required to do the job today, but not necessarily tomorrow. Whereas as you say, second mover places. Had a much more comprehensive perspective about education and skills, and then applied it.
Yeah, Nick Crafts and others who've done the international research. You can see it.
Yeah.
There was, this wasn't just. It was a valid competitive strategy that businesses here chose to take, but there's pretty clear evidence. I mean, there's so much on which there isn't clear evidence.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things that shocked me. Perhaps as a PhD. There is clear evidence that as the Industrial Revolution wore on, the returns to investment in human capital innovation went up quite significantly, and we never secured those in the ways that the places who had a different form of industrialisation succeeded in.
Yeah, and is that, in a sense, is that largely, that's really part of the explanation for, why we saw quite rapid, really, decline of our industrial cities, in that, they didn't have these institutional arrangements, these interlocking networks that allowed them to respond to and adapt to the prevailing market global conditions as the cotton industry globalised and competition was, you know, felt in India and in the US and everywhere else, the institutions weren't able to be, you know, to be able to respond in that way, and so we just saw this gradual decline. Is that it? I mean,
The truth is that in relation to cities, we don't know. I mean, if the research is out there, I couldn't find it.
No.
I mean, your own Paul Swinney and others have done some research that was really that I use in the book that's really important in helping me tell the story. The best guess that I can make is that what you just said is right. You know, there was an element of hubris in the British industrial model that we had. You know, we were massively dependent on these firms for our cotton for our exports. Cotton exports, I think, at one point was for textiles exports at one point was 70% by value of all Britain's exports. So that's 70%. And exactly as you describe, as second and third waves of industrialisation happened, they had different models that seemed to add more value. You know, the transport patterns changed. The value of proximity that was so fundamentally important in Britain in the early 19th century was less important as the car came on stream. There's all these factors contributed. But the key point you make is, I think, is right. It's that at the point where those cold winds start to blow, do those firms battle alone, doing what they've always done, you know, competing down wages, stealing each other's staff, or is there a socialised system that understands that this is not a threat to any one company, it's a systemic threat to the place, to the industry, and work to solve it? And, you know, I remember as a treasury, just to give you an example of how this is an issue, probably not today, but certainly not in the course of my working lifetime. If there's one contrast I would draw, I went on a sort of clusters visit when I was in the treasury with the financial secretary to the treasury at the time, Stephen Timms, and we looked at the Third Italy. We went to Modena, and I remember going into a demo centre for the auto industry, and there was, funded partly by the employers' organisation and partly by the communist-controlled regional authority, was a demo centre with some people who were basically reverse engineering a piece of Japanese or Korean kit, ready for a bunch of entrepreneurs coming in to look at what they could learn from it. Yeah. And then the next day as a group of small and medium enterprises in the town, in a town in southern Lombardy, where they were making a very huge proportion of the EU's stock of dialysis disposable equipment and blood bags.
Yeah.
And that was SMEs working together. If I contrast that with two examples I found in my career, I remember in about 1991, 92, when I was much younger, I remember doing work in Luton's hat sector, where I went to with people in, very much informed by the work of Beccatini and Porter and all these other people, going to talk to them about whether or not they'd ever cooperate.
Yeah.
And when I suggested to serially in one-to-one interviews that hat manufacturers that they might want to do something other than cooperate on the annual colour swatch, they thought this was an abominable suggestion.
Yeah.
I remember asking some of these guys, what would you do if one of the competitors came and knocked at the door? I said, well, we'll slam the door in the face so they couldn't see what we were doing.
Yeah.
I found the same thing in the Norfolk boat building industry, which is a great industry, where we could double, quadruple, quintuple output, but there's no great desire to do it because they're happy doing the bespoke thing they do.
Mm.
This speaks to me, and these are two slightly random examples, a counter post against a very different example in the Third Italy, of how this wider culture, which actually narrows its origins to some really deep historic factors, how they can produce very different forms of activity, where in one it seems okay to work together, to collaborate with some people one day and then to compete against them the next, whereas ours is individualist, that says that you know, business associations and government has no real role in trying to get people together to collaborate and compete.
Yeah.
It's down to us. Something that I think that, you know, the worst bits of Thatcherism seem to very much to emphasise over and above a version of markets that I think is a far wiser, richer one, which is that they are human constructions where relationships matter, where if you can do things together, you can very often achieve more than if you just have a model of naked competition with no collaboration.
And of course, that observation, which I think you make in the book, of contrasting modes of operation, modes of organisation, which are deeply ingrained in the history, the culture, the institutional arrangements of those places. I think you do say this in the book, means that whilst we can observe what goes on in Spain or Barcelona or Germany and Munich, our ability to borrow fundamentally and replicate what they're doing is going to be a very, very tall order, very, very significant challenge as well. I think you say that
in the book,
in part because of these long run, deeply ingrained, kind of quite fundamental differences that operate at the, you know, at different levels.
I do say that, and I mean it. I don't say it with any great joy either. No. I mean, you know, just take a Chamber of Commerce. What is a Chamber of Commerce? Well, it means something very different here to what it means in Hamburg.
Yeah.
And, you know, personally, I intellectually quite like the idea of a statutory Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
In which a business association has an in into every business because they're paying the thing. When Heseltine floated the idea when his nose at stone unturned report, and he actually did a specific report on the issue.
Yeah.
I mean, people were falling about laughing in large parts of Whitehall, thinking the man was a fool. I mean, and if you read the government's response to it, they say that the Treasury's response, they responded to it, and they didn't even give him the courtesy of responding.
No,
it's because our conception of a chamber is very, very different. Curiously, my office is based in the Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce, and there's a debate I'm having with them about what would it take to have a deeper role for Chambers of Commerce in helping knit business together to help spot opportunities, rather than having what we have in, it's a big chamber, biggest in the country, one that is essentially at the whim of what members want on any given day, with no great ability to cooperate. And so that's true in so many other ways. So when we, you know, I was part of the group of people who invited Michael Porter over to the Treasury for the first time and started to investigate clusters.
Yeah.
And you know, quite predictably, within a very short period of time, what happened was that we took the idea of clusters, of dense networks of firms and demo centres like I was describing in Emilia-Romagna and patterns of competition and collaboration like you see throughout the Third Italy, and we turned it into every market town in Britain decided it was going to be a biotech cluster without ever having understood the journey that you have to go through to get there, which would have led most of them to abandon what is a pretty absurd goal because they've got no skin in the biotech game.
Yeah, not quite. I want to. Well, we'll move on to in a minute onto because, as I said at the start, you're not an academic, and you know you're very interested in the policy questions and issues that reflecting on our urban history tell us about where we are today, particularly given where we are today in terms of you know the changes that we see in our urban areas and some of the institutional changes that are underway and hopefully will be embedded and expanded over time. But just also in the book, as part of the explanation, or as you begin to explore the kind of urban decline period, you know, after the post-industrial decline, you raise some really interesting stories around local government and its ability to engage and respond to big challenges around public health, particularly, but not exclusively. And then some of the questions and issues that national government begins to think about and looks at these local governments and says, hang on, you know, these are big issues. You're not responding to these in the way that we deem appropriate. We are going to step in, which very quickly becomes a systemized approach, which, you know, you talk about, ultimately leads us to the centralized system of health and education, and everything else that we pretty much live with today, although it's been unpicked, you know, in the very recent past, or begun to be unpicked. But just say a little bit more about that kind of interplay between, you know, the local government response dealing with decline, their inability, unwillingness, whatever, and then why central government was kind of getting involved.
I mean, I think there are two separate sets of arguments in that. The first is that the real benefit for me and some people who commented on the book, though not everybody who's commented on the book, is that the real insight of the historical analysis is that the problems we are grappling with, with which we really seem to struggle in parliamentary cycles to come up with answers, The reason we struggle with them is they're not small recent problems. They're 200-year-old issues.
Yeah.
And that's the real insight that comes out of the history. But the other one, which goes directly to your point, is about the nature of political power. And, you know, this is a new argument, I think. I've certainly, you know, many of the arguments I make in the book are ones that I've borrowed and hopefully correctly attributed to others. But what really struck me were looking at this was that, you know, if you have these new industrial cities who were the first time potentially challenging London's dominance as the epicentre of the British economy, generating all these exports, creating vast new places with millions of people in them, that at the moment of their biggest power, where the Anti-Corn Law League, you know, dealt a death knell to the aristocracy's grip on Parliament, putting the interests of business people and working people right at the heart of politics. Mm. You know, they did that, but what they never did was to do the things that were needed to get Parliament off their back on the long term.
Right.
Because they didn't fix their housing problems, they didn't fix their sanitation problems, they patently didn't fix their skills and innovation problems, which meant that the things that if they'd done their knitting properly on those, what should have been for them absolutely core issues, they, I think, would have developed in a far more fiscally autonomous, powerful way. I think they missed their moment. They had a moment to strike a deal with what was in the 1850s a very, very rudimentary emergent form of national government in Britain. They had an opportunity to strike a deal and they blew it. And if that isn't a message for cities today, I don't know what is.
And have you a sense as to, you know, what were the factors that enabled them or resulted in them missing that opportunity? I mean,
hubris. I think it was hubris. It was. I think it's hard to read the histories of that time and conclude anything other than they just didn't believe in the power of their business to solve problems and of the role of charity in fixing the things that they couldn't. And, you know, the role of good government in Sienese style was or Venetian or Florentine or Athenian or any of the precedents that they were fond to quote, was something that which seems with hindsight to have been anathema to them. And that's what led to that, you know, series of whether it's the 1835 Act that got rid of rotten boroughs, right the way through the series of sanitation and housing reviews, you know, from a national government machine in High Victoriana that had no great desire to intervene. This was a national view about not, you know, wanting small government, but they had to do it because there were such manifest problems in the cities.
I think one of the interesting elements in the themes that runs through the book is, you know, that sort of honest reflective where opportunities were presented or presented themselves and were missed by cities as much as by government. And you know, I think often you get critiques where, you know, the decline has been only, you know, it's all the problems of one side or the other.
Sure.
And actually, you know, the opportunities go and get missed by lots of, and certainly parallels to today in the sort of devolution conversations we've had in different places and their inability to organise to do something about
it. And it's important to make a distinction because, you know, at no point do I claim that local government wasn't very powerful during the sort of, you know, late 19th, right through the early 20th and later periods. There's a difference between local government being powerful as holding big budgets, delivering services.
Yeah.
And there's a very big difference between that and cities and big civic authorities being powerful political players and shaping the destiny of the country.
Yeah.
Where I'd argue that the former these two can coexist, where you have local government that's a powerful agent of social change by delivering services, which I think by the 20th century it clearly was, but having lost their power as national players in a way that, you know, I mean, the notion, yeah, Andy Byrne just elected as a mayor of Greater Manchester.
Yeah.
This is an interesting step into a different world, that you step away from being a would-be prime minister to being a mayor.
Yeah.
This is almost French.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big move. It's saying, actually, political power and the power of place and place leadership is a different issue to the issue of service budgets. Now, they're related, but you can certainly have budgets and still have no political power.
Yeah, not quite. Let's turn to, two things. There's policy implications on the back of it, because I think, you know, the second half of the book begins to unpick, you know, the different growth models that are advocated or at least illustrated and talked about in the way that we think about why growth. And clearly, you know, the title of the book, Britain's Cities, Britain's Future, clearly, you know, if in your perspective, in my perspective, you know, having successful, strong, politically, economically vibrant cities is the only real way, I would argue, and you might argue the same, to have a successful country. You know, in a sense, a prosperous country requires prosperous cities. That's a contested perspective. You raise that in the book, in a sense, there are these differences of perspectives. You know, you use geographers on the one hand and economists on the other to illustrate that. I know that you know that, you know, it's more nuanced than that, but there are these kind of different views on why the economy looks like it does and ultimately what we can do. So just say a little bit about that, where you're coming from on all those sorts of things. And then I think that plays to the some of the policy questions and issues and policy suggestions that you make in the final chapter.
Sure. I mean, let's start with the substantive issue and then come back to the economics and geography thing. The nature of deindustrialisation in this country was so quick and so profound in its endgame, even if it had been a long time in the making, that the economies of many former industrial areas are still deeply and profoundly scarred.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think those of us who work in policy, who work for prime ministers, chancellors and leaders, who have got choices to make, have got to work within a world where we say we cannot reinvent that, we cannot start from a different place, we cannot pretend that we're France or Germany or the Nordic countries with a state that has the resources and the political consent for massive large-scale intervention.
Yeah.
And that's partly because some of what we did when we did massive large-scale intervention didn't work very well,
yeah.
Even if that's true of liberal reform as well. So for those reasons, I've arrived at, yeah, over a long period of work in this area at the view, not that cities are the answer, but that there is no way back for large parts of our country in which the cities don't drive it.
Mm-hmm.
And the best thing, the best way of explaining this, and it's anyone's ever heard me talk before, we're bored hearing it again. It's to say if Manchester and Liverpool could do for the north and west, and Leeds and Sheffield could do for the north and east, and Birmingham, Coventry, and the others could do for the middle bit of the country, what London has done for the southern and eastern bit, nearly all of our problems would be over. Blackpool would be an issue, Barrow would be an issue, Hastings is an issue, but that's a better world than the world we're in, mm-hmm. And that's the world I think we were trying to create in what I was doing in Manchester. It was what was behind the City Growth Commission. It's behind a lot of what we do now. And that's because, you know, when I started work, I did work in Basildon, Harlow and Luton and places like that. And they were not the land of milk and honey.
Mm.
And even if they're not quite the land of milk and honey now, they are prosperous places by the standards of virtually anywhere in the country. And that's what the London phenomenon has done. And I think it's what an urban-led model of growth can be. And of course there's a Cambridge that's a counterfactual, a small place that's very prosperous, and there's a York that's a counterfactual, though both of them are dependent on a big city nearby. And that I think is the substantive argument that absolutely comes out of the book. You mentioned the economics and geography thing, and I have to mention it because you haven't yet.
Yeah.
You know, among the reviews of the book there's been one very critical one, mm-hmm. which draws attention to what was described as a straw man that I paint on that. But you know, I'm a Briton, I'm a proud Briton. Everything I've ever done has been about trying to make this country better. And if people want to knock the book, I put myself up to make comments. I'm big and old enough to take criticism, and there's some valid criticisms you could make of the book, not ones that have been made, mind you. The plain fact is that in the 30 years I've been in this game, we've had a succession of geographers and urban planners and others advise CLG, and a succession of economists and others advising BIS or the Treasury, and each of them has got something valuable to say. But I submit to you as well that in that period we have spent billions and billions of pounds on different initiatives. Now, we don't have a counterfactual, we don't know what would have happened had we not spent that money, but it patently hasn't worked.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've all got to ask ourselves, me as much as anybody else, what went wrong? Because our failure as a country to get a growth model that works with a public sector set of interventions that make it better, I think is one of the things that has led to the referendum result. Mm. Because we have failed to make places left behind by deindustrialisation feel like they're places where people want to live and set up businesses. And I don't think we can go on much longer with a geography literature, whatever it says in academic journals is fine, and I, you know, fight for the right people to say whatever they want in academic journals.
Yeah,
advising CLG ministers to do things that economists believe profoundly and strongly are wrong, at the same time as those same economists are going into the Treasury arguing for things that have profound social consequences that are too often dismissed as externalities. Mm-hmm. Because those of us who've advised ministers, who have advised leaders, like you do every day of the week, have to balance those two sets of considerations. And I don't think these guys are ever going to agree, nor do I think they necessarily should agree. But why I've come up with that sort of, you know, big cities first-led approach, because it's the best take I can come up with on how I square the circle between these two different sets of perspectives. And I say clearly on the record, I don't think it's acceptable for our country, in the state it's in now, given the revolution of that vote and what could happen if we get the next 10 years wrong, for us to continue this standoff in which everybody advises the people who happens to agree with them, and we don't get to the bottom of what a sensible range of things might be that are that take account of other people's epistemologies that we don't happen to care for, for the benefit of the country.
So we'll come to some of the policy suggestions. You just carry on with that. Unsurprisingly, you know, I would agree with you. So how do we move forward? How do we reconcile? How do we bring about, you know, the differing views? Because both argue that they're right. Both say they have, you know, evidence or analysis on their side. You see this in the various publications. Each puts up their, you know, their best professor or their best thinker on these sorts of things, argues it for a slightly different perspective. Some emphasise fairness and redistribution, as you say. You know, that comes a stronger theme in some respects. Others argue for, you know, for concentration and recognising then we need to think about how places and people are connected in. You know, how do we resolve? How do we reconcile? You know, you're the policy maker in the middle. You know, you're the convener of these different interests. Mike, you've been doing this stuff for a long time. I mean, to be honest, I'm telling you what you know. These were the issues you were dealing with in Greater Manchester, right? This is Greater Manchester writ large. This is how do we reconcile Oldham and Rochdale with, you know, inner urban Manchester and inner urban Trafford and Salford. Everything's going to central Manchester, nothing's going to Oldham. That, you know, the model's broken, it's not really helping. I mean, that's, you experienced that for 10, 15 years.
That's the argument, it's got some truth in it. So, I don't think there is a single answer to that. I mean, no. I really do want to. I've just joined the ESRC research committee, and I want to have conversations with those guys about doing some work in this space. I've done it once before when I was at the University of Manchester when I set up IPEC. I actually wrote to the then Economic Secretary Ed Balls, and we put a bit of money into something called the Manchester Treasury Initiative that was designed to do this. It patently didn't work, but it did bring them all together for a conference.
Yeah.
I want to go back to that because I genuinely think. People like me don't often talk about being patriots, but in the end, we've got to be. Our country faces quite some big choices.
Absolutely right.
And they're too important to be left for this sort of debate, whatever the differences are. So I think there's a national thing to be done. Yeah. You know, if I can help in stimulating that, you bet your life I'm going to. But actually, virtue begins at home. I think the stuff that we did in Manchester, that I know you've been doing with the What Works Centre in lots of other places, and I do with every place I work with, is to start with the place and evidence and facts and trying to imbue a sense of evidence-based research to ensure that whenever elected members who are not experts are taking advice, they have advice before them that is the very best it can be based on the best evidence. The best analysis of what markets might do as a result, and the best analysis of what the social consequences are too. And I think it is a sad fact that too many of the social costs of market reforms have been just treated as uncosted externalities in lots of models. Mm. And I've never agreed with that, but it's, you know, like everybody else, I've been on a journey through it. So I think, to your question about somewhere like Greater Manchester, I was having this debate in the margins of the conference I spoke at this morning with your own Naomi Clayton,
yep,
with Tom Stannard of Oldham.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is the debate we've got to have. And, you know, if I'd love to do some work that's getting back into that debate,
mm,
opening up the space of inclusive growth, looking at what came out of the RSA commission and starting to look at policy interventions. I think two things.
Mm.
I reference it in the book, the debate, is it people or is it place?
Yep.
You know, too often the economics assumes that if you fix the people, it'll all be fine. Well, it doesn't.
No.
At least the places that are pretty damned benighted.
Yeah.
All the investment we've seen in place hasn't made them places that people want to live, with very, very, very few exceptions, which happen to be in urban centres,
yeah,
very largely. I think we've got to rethink welfare policy, and we've got to rethink skills policy. I think what the RSA is doing in the work that Matthew Taylor's doing for the Prime Minister is really important about,
yeah,
looking at the gig economy and how it can be better regulated. I think cities should be absolutely screaming from the rooftops for better regulation of the labour market, so that more cities have got the thing that made them.
Yeah.
Good quality work,
yeah,
which they haven't got at the moment.
Yeah.
I think, I talk in the book, I mean, the most passionate bit of the book for me is the bit about long-term unemployment.
Mm.
Yeah, I think one of the guilty secrets of all industrial cities is that beneath the aggregates is still the last generation caught by industrial change,
yeah,
and their children, and their, sometimes their grandchildren, who've never had a good experience of work.
Yeah.
That's stuff we've got to get into. I think the more tricky bit of the inclusive growth place is around capital projects,
yeah,
where, you know, I'm a deep sceptic that simply trying to even out the resource, you know, building grey A offices in every market town is a good idea.
No.
You know, as I say in the book, if the best rents, if the highest rents in town are £10 a square foot, and, you know, you need £20 or £30 a square foot to stack up a commercial development, unless there's somebody you know who's going to occupy that building, if you do a spec development, you're going to be paying the difference between those two figures out of your revenue budget.
Absolutely.
And that's not giving money you're not going to have for things that could make a difference.
No.
Skills, employment, housing, education. Education.
Yeah.
Or in fact, as I was saying this morning, putting the money into subsidising tram fares,
yeah,
driving down tram or bus fares so that people can commute better. So, again, though, that I think that points to me to the need for us to have a more intelligent, evidence-led, thorough debate, which, frankly, given the denuded state of most public authorities and how few people there are to do this stuff, is really hard for them to do right now, which is why the combined authorities and the mayors are such a,
yeah,
a big step forward.
Well, let's kind of finish on that, on those issues, you know, bring it right up to date. As you said, a week ago today, Greater Manchester, Greater Liverpool, four other places, West Mids, voted in their very first metro mayors. We certainly saw that, I'm sure you did, saw that as a very good point, high point, not the highest, we hope, but a very positive move in trying to provide our cities with, you know, some of the ammunition and the instruments that they're going to need to, you know, to deal with their current situation, never mind adapt to whatever's coming down the line. But just, you know, give us a sense of, you know, where are you in terms of the Metro Mayors, you know, good thing, enthusiastic, and
of course,
you know,
enthusiastic.
What's next?
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic, and I think, you know, turnouts were double what I was expecting.
Yeah, quite.
You know, again, how many people have I heard say this is a disaster, it's a disgrace, they're not high enough? Well, no, they're not high enough, but neither's turnout in a general election.
No.
And this was a year where there weren't local elections, yeah, in most of these places, so, you know, cut us a bit of slack.
Yeah.
I'd say over a third of people, only just over a third of people voted in the first London election.
Yeah.
And now turnouts
45, 46%.
So, you know, 25, 30% people voting. hey, that's given that these are not the most powerful institutions going, you know, people aren't shouting from the open shore omnibus about the powers that are being going to these mayors. This is a very evolutionary start. I think that's a pretty good start. I think it is just a start, though. And, you know, the mayors have got some powers, but they haven't got many. The capacity behind them in some areas is not as strong as it needs to be. They, you know, I don't think they've done some of the hard economic thinking. You know, what is, you know, what really is Teesside for? What really is the West Midlands for? We did that 10 years ago when we did the Manchester Independent Economic Review. Mm-hmm. Probably needs redoing. I think there's a lot more work is needed. And there's still a danger, even some of those mayoralties, but especially in those places that are aspiring to that model or have got combined authorities, that they treat it like a lunch club, a ruse for getting money out of central government.
Yeah, quite.
The change that hopefully these mayoralties embody, and it is an inadequate and it is an imperfect one, is the start of recognising that this is not a collection of local authorities. It's a place.
Absolutely right.
It's a big place with you know, 1, 2, 3 million people living there who cross our ridiculous boundaries every day of the week for myriad things.
Yeah.
And I think what the mayors give us the opportunity to do, and it's an opportunity that need not be taken to the 19th century cities, is to start to recognise that we can run these great cities as the places that they really are, and not to just play play the games of who gets what within them and work out what the right model is, what the big projects are to back. But you know, it's whatever it is, day five, day four of their existence, and that's something that I think will be put to the test for the first time in 3 years. At which point it'll still be far too soon to say.
No. And I think you make a great point, and certainly one that we've been making, which is for them to see themselves as, you know, the leader of their place. And allied to that, get your final thoughts on this. I was quite struck in the run up. To the mayoral elections, where, you know, if you talk to officials in the combined authorities, they were talking about how they were going to sort of, you know, try to hem in the, you know, the mayors, you know, control what they had access to, the policy briefings and all the rest of it. You know, my perspective, look, firstly, they're politicians. That's quite a hard thing to do anyway. You know, they go where they go. But actually, you make this point all the time through the book. Yeah, they are the leaders of their place, which means their mandate and their remit has to be necessarily broad, because if they only focus on the economy, the social institutions, the cultural institutions, the learning institutions, the innovation institutions, all of which really matter to the success of the place and for the people who live there, we won't be, you know, we won't be thinking adequately about them in the same way as we probably didn't in the, you know, in the Victorian cities of the past. So, you know, I think broad remit, not constrained by your policy brief, you know, I think is the way to try and...
There's a section in the report where I talk about the cultural legacy of cities, which is something I've, you know, taken an intense personal interest in. And I one of the bits of advice I give to the new mayors is just to remember that the £1 million pot you announced today will have £1 million worth of benefits, which will be very small in most of these cities because they're, you know, they're 10, 20, 30, 50, 60 billion pound a year GVA economies. And do them because they matter, and there are things you can do with £1 million that are worthwhile. But the real test of these mayoralties is going to be in several generations when people look back the way I've looked back at the people who built the city I grew up in and ask the question, did they leave a lasting impact? And that impact is likely to be in buildings, of which we've seen plenty this last period. Mm-hmm. It's going to be in successful businesses, of which I don't think we have seen enough. Where's the billion-dollar companies coming out of Leeds or Manchester or Birmingham? Mm-hmm. That they are a bit thin on the ground. Mm-hmm. And therefore, above all, it might be about the institutions that give rise to those companies, institutions of learning, of innovation, of culture, of transport.
Mm.
Of transport systems that are fit for the cities that built the modern world, and that very often seems a daunting thing to say when you know, people have just been elected with no budgets, no powers over half these things.
Yeah.
But the great lesson of mayors, and it's the great lesson of the people that George Osborne took his advice from in his readings when he was thinking about the Northern Powerhouses, the powers you have today don't matter as much as the influence you want to have and the vision you're prepared to bring to the job you've got. And I think that's the message for the mayors.
My guest today has been Mike Emmerich. Mike, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter, at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.